the Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener.
Here to talk about cybersecurity, some recent headlines, and hopefully provide some insight and analysis and practical application that you can take back to the office and help secure your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And maybe when the Dark Side Group releases their decryptor, I'll finally get a chance to turn on the light again in my bathroom, because using it in the dark is always a crapshoot. All right, so the first article we're going to talk about is from Krebs on Security, and this is discussing the Dark Side ransomware gang's announcement that they're closing up shop. So apparently, they had several pieces of their infrastructure seized by what was claimed to be law enforcement. So they had their blog, their payment servers, and their CDN servers taken offline, or the ability for them to access them at least was affected.
I love that they have a content delivery network. I don't know why. I couldn't tell you why, but I love that they have a content delivery network.
I wonder if it's like Cloudflare or if it's something else. Because I know that when I've gone to different websites, I use a JavaScript blocker, and you'll look at the site and it'll say, you know, like bob.com CDN. So I wonder if all this is like darksidecdn.com or whatever.
I mean, all this just makes me think of like actual companies and just picture like the trappings of, you know, the dark side leaders, like the CEO, and they've got an HR department and, you know, making sure that, you know, their monthly quotas are being met and everything. I wonder if they're having, you know, performance management discussions with their ransomware people. You didn't hit your metrics last year, you know, what's a good Victor? I need you to bring in another couple thousand Bitcoin.
Oh, they may have those, but I doubt that they're taking place in an HR office. They're probably taking place in a back alley with a guy named Vinny in a lead pipe.
And he doesn't sound very Russian, though.
Ivan. But it's not surprising that they sound it, because these are really businesses. It's just that their services, if you will, is not legal.
Capitalism always triumphs.
Yeah, it's awesome. They posted a notification on a crime where a cybercrime forum in Russian, which outlined exactly what the situation was, and they said hosting support apart from information at the request of law enforcement agencies does not provide any other information. So their hosting provider for these services apparently had a banner page which indicated that these sites were seized by law enforcement, and that's all they said. So some other security experts online have suspected that this actually might not be true, and this is an exit scam by the dark side gang in order to attempt to get out of the market. Now, it's a plausible idea, but I find it interesting that they also claim that they will compensate outstanding financial obligations by May 23rd to their affiliates. Now, if it were simply an exit scam where they were trying to take the money and run, I'm not sure why they would indicate a date so close. You know, maybe a date 30 days or farther out would make more sense for them to say, hey, you're going to get your money back, but you're not going to get it by this date. This seems really too close to the site going down to be that kind of scam. Unless they really got they've got their go bag ready, and you know, this is all the time they need to get out. But I would expect that they want more time there. Because one of the things that they also mentioned, this is why they think it's grab the money and go, is that apparently they claim that in addition to their servers being shut down by law enforcement, that they also had their crypto wallets emptied. And I'm not sure which crypto coins or which cryptocurrency they were using. If it's Bitcoin, it strikes me as odd that that would happen unless they had their private key online for those for that wallet to be emptied. Because I had not heard about law enforcement emptying crypto wallets in response to cyber attacks before. But it kind of makes sense that they would do it, though, if you look at a crypto wallet in the from the perspective of a financial instrument. Because when you have, a gangster or whatever taken down, the government seizes their bank accounts and freezes the funds within the bank accounts. So I kind of think that the crypto wallet is the same kind of thing. It's just a different financial instrument for the government to seize. It just would be more difficult depending on the cryptocurrency involved. I'm not familiar with any other, the inner workings of any other systems, and even Bitcoin, I'm not really well versed in it, but at least for Bitcoin, you need that private key in order to access that. And I'm not sure how the law enforcement folks would have gotten that unless these guys left it on one of these systems, which also would not be too surprising considering how poor the OPSEC in general is for the cybercrime folks.
I actually would wonder, would that be a valid deterrent strategy whenever they target something that's kind of nationally important for someone in law enforcement or the military or, you know, the NSA, CIA to like swoop in and take away their money, especially with something like Bitcoin, where there's no way to get it back at all, even if they laundered it, you know, legitimately.
I would certainly assume so, because that's the whole reason that they're in business. And actually, that's something that it was almost like a press release after the Colonial Pipeline thing came out saying, hey, we're just after money. And if you take that away, you take away their incentive. So that would make sense that would be a disincentive for them to take these kind of actions. But the question would be, if it's that good of an incentive, why aren't they always doing this? So that must be a higher bar to execute on. Otherwise, that would happen all the time.
Yeah.
But something else that the Dark Side organization said they were going to do is release a decryptor program for companies who have been ransomware but not paid yet. And if I understand the statement correctly, they are releasing the decryptor to their affiliates, not necessarily to the organizations who have been ransomware. So that would still allow the affiliates to collect on the ransom, not necessarily free the organizations that are being held ransom. So that'll allow the affiliates to still collect on a endeavor already in progress.
That's unfortunate.
And I think that one of the key things in the statement as well is that they say the affiliate program is closed. That does not mean that this group is still not going to do ransomware themselves. You know, they've got a lot of technology and work built up into this their ransomware product. So I don't see them simply quitting the ransomware market altogether, but just the affiliate program.
Yeah, that makes sense. They're just trying to get the heat off them.
Right. What's also interesting is that other ransomware gangs are seeing the writing on the wall, if you will, based on this whole event. So the Reval ransomware gang also posted a statement saying that henceforth they will forbid attacks on organizations in the social sector, such as healthcare, education, or government. And I think this, and additionally, they're going to require their affiliates to receive approval prior to execution of whoever they're going to ransomware. So they're going to start quality controlling who they're going to allow their affiliates to ransomware.
This does sound a lot like a business, doesn't it?
It sounds very corporate for sure. And basically what they're saying is they're not going to let any one affiliate impact their bottom line by doing something stupid.
I mean, that makes sense. As long as you're not doing too much damage, the authorities are mostly looking the other way, or at least enough that, you know, as long as you don't fly into the US or somewhere with an extradition.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think it's really more along the lines of who your target is. So if you remember a few years ago, Maersk got hit with ransomware. That's a huge shipping conglomerate. And they had 4,000 servers and 4,500 PCs. get ransomware, and it took them offline for, I think, a month.
Yeah, it was a while.
Unfortunately, I don't remember the exact time frame there, but I know it took them at least 6 months to fully recover from that. And that was a Danish transport and logistics company. So I think it's not so much a matter of the size or the impact so much as the associated government's ability to respond. Because I almost am certain that had that been an American logistics company versus a Danish logistics company, this may have actually happened sooner, where we're seeing these kind of activity from the U.S. federal government. Because if you notice the ransomware, or if you think about it, these ransomware crews have been attempting to stay off the United States government's radar, because up to this point, you've heard them ransomware schools, hospitals, local municipalities, but you don't hear about ransomwaring U.S. federal government agencies, because they don't want to cross that line. And I guess they didn't realize that how big that target was, maybe, or how critical that piece of infrastructure was that they were, or the organization that maintained that critical infrastructure of the Colonial Pipeline was. Because the federal government hasn't cared up to this point. Well, I wouldn't say hadn't cared, but they haven't actioned anything up to this point yet. As I said, those list of organizations that have been ransomware before. So this got me thinking, saying, okay, well, if this had been the scourge, or if the federal government had seen ransomware as the scourge it is before this event, and they could have taken these actions that they took against the dark side crew before, they're only doing it now. Is this really going to change the overall importance the U.S. federal government puts on fighting ransomware?
Yeah.
Because I think this is a pretty effective strategy, because you just see, based on the ripples that you're seeing in the environment, how the criminal element is responding to this. So if they'd done this before, maybe this wouldn't have even happened, or we wouldn't be dealing with it as much as we are. And is this really going to be how they handle it going forward? I'm doubtful. You're probably only going to see these kind of actions again when you do see another major ransomware incident like this with a critical infrastructure. And considering how nervous this has made these ransomware crews, I'm not sure if you will see it again.
I find it interesting how big, or at least how much publicity, a lot of these ransomware gangs want, the way they're deliberately kind of cultivating, hey, everybody look at me, I do ransomware. I wonder if this is going to change. I mean, because on one hand, they do have to advertise to get those affiliates to take the risks for them. I mean, they're just the developers. They're, you know, the Adobes of the criminal world. And somehow they've got to get people to break into systems for them and run their software for them and then pay them part of it. But on the other hand, they probably want to stay under the radar from the perspective of the government and the law enforcement.
I think that's what you're going to see now. There's also mentioned that forums where they had previously posted their advertisements for their affiliate programs and stuff are saying, well, you can't even talk about ransomware activity anymore on our forums. And they've gone back, and some of these large criminal forums have gone back and deleted previous posts discussing ransomware advertisements and sales. It's kind of got me thinking about the cancel culture of crimeware.
That's funny.
And additionally, it seems like besides targeting just this particular ransomware gang, they're also trying to attack the cryptocurrency infrastructure that supports it. There's a mixing service called BitMix that's used by one of the ransomware gangs called Abaddon, and it has ceased operations, but no one seems to know why.
Yeah, that's where you put in Bitcoins and you get out different Bitcoins, right? So you can no longer track via Ledger all the transactions.
Yeah, if I understand it correctly, you put in Bitcoins and they do a bunch of transactions, shuffling it around, and then spit it out to a different wallet. But of course, that's my novice interpretation of it. I haven't done a lot of research on how these things function. Now, one of the associated articles with the Krebs one was a article on ZDNet, and they talked to a fellow named Roger Grimes from KnowBe4. And he says that the main problem with ransomware is that the people behind it cannot be arrested.
Yeah, the developers. Well, you mean the developers, attackers, or does he mean the gangs, or?
Well, I think he means the entire ecosystem, really. The affiliates, the ransomware developers, I think just the whole infrastructure. Because he's saying many countries have no problem with cyber criminals originating from their company so long as those criminals don't act within that country.
Mm-hmm. And that's something you've talked about before for sure, where as long as they target somebody else somewhere else, the government mostly just doesn't care.
Right. And I think that's really true of every country, not just some countries. The difference is that if you're going to target another country, you also have to ensure that country is at odds with your country.
Yeah.
You know, an American hacker attacking China is not going to raise any red flags to anybody. But an American attacker attacking a British company or a British individual is going to raise flags because those two countries coordinate together. It's just a matter of the alliances between countries, because in this type of situation where you're talking about Russian criminals, they're at odds with the United States. But if you switch that around, the United States is at odds with Russia, but the number of countries, I guess this is probably a miscategorization, but on the US side is much larger ecosystem than the countries on the Russian side. So that's where you have that disproportion or disproportionality. You know, if the roles were reversed, then I think you'd see a similar situation evolve. And there's been a proposal by the UN to supposedly come up with a digital Geneva Convention, which was written up in March. But I mean, they could just not sign it.
What would a digital Geneva Convention involve? I mean, I guess like not attacking hospitals, not attacking like power plants.
Yeah, the link will be in the show notes to the UN paper.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I've never, generally when I think of Geneva Convention, I think of like torture and treatment of prisoners, but I guess it probably covered a lot more than that, huh?
Well, it has to deal with hostilities.
Oh, rules that apply in times of armed conflict. This, you know, this podcast is really good at exposing and really sharing my own ignorances.
But if they're not a signatory to the Geneva Convention, it's not going to hold anybody to anything.
And we still see, you know, issues. There are lots of times where, you know, during the fog of war, the Geneva Convention rules aren't necessarily followed.
Right. And additionally, that's kind of a miscategorization anyhow, because the cyber criminals now are more like pirates than they are state actors, which is, you know, what the original Geneva Convention was designed to rein in, was the actions by people on behalf of states.
Yeah, they don't even have like whatever the modern equivalent of letters of marque would be either. They're just, for England, as long as the pirates are raiding French vessels, they probably were just like, you know, a little head tilt and go by.
Right. They used to call them privateers.
Well, no, that's what I was saying about the letter of marque part, though, because the at least privateers did have an acknowledgement from the government that said, you know, yeah, you're kind of sort of part of our Navy, whereas now it's even more tenuous than that.
Well, that's still in the United States Constitution anyway, so the United States could write those up, but they just never do.
That would actually be really interesting if during a time of war or conflict, if the government started kind of handing those out again, being like, you know what, if you hit the Bank of North Korea and stole $10 million from North Korea, you know, we're not going to do anything about that.
Well, actually, that was Ron Paul had proposed that for Osama bin Laden.
Really?
Saying we could issue a letter of marque for a $1 billion bounty for Osama bin Laden. And that still would have saved us, what, trillions of dollars. by giving some organ, it would probably end up being like a team of ex-special forces guys or a or a PMC or something that probably would have taken that $1 billion, but still would have saved a bunch of money and lives by doing that kind of action.
That's a really interesting way to do that.
So you could probably still do that in the cyber realm too. Imagine issuing a letter of marque for the Revil ransomware gang. And you'd have, you know, cyber attackers or hackers or whatever.
Especially if you get to keep their Bitcoin.
Oh yeah. That's just a bonus.
That's interesting. And again, like, I don't think the government's going to physically issue those or do that. But yeah, that's the feeling I'm getting from our discussions, is that the government is just kind of winking and nodding.
Yeah, it's just not in my backyard.
Exactly.
So the reason that this is even relevant to most folks is that this is, I think, pretty obvious that this is going to impact the entire ransomware environment ecosystem or crimeware environment in ways we don't even understand yet. And it's going to be, you know, months, if not years, before we see exactly how all these repercussions have flushed out. It's kind of similar to, the analogy doesn't hold exactly, but Pablo Escobar. So when he was taken down, he was actually managing the drug trade from the from production to the dealer. He had that whole thing sewn up within his organization.
Yeah, he was stepping on the CIA's territory.
And when they took him down, that ended up getting broken up into a bunch of different organizations.
All the baby bells.
Right. And that had not been foreseen at the time that it occurred. And I think the actions that have been taken now against DarkSide are going to have similar kinds of repercussions that we don't know what those are yet. And it's not going to get rid of ransomware. As I was mentioned earlier, this is just getting really rid of the affiliate programs, or maybe not even doing that, but those affiliate programs are going to be much more tight knit and much closer. It's kind of like you can't get into something unless you're referred by a member or something like that. So it's going to be like clubs almost. This is just my speculation on it, where, you know, if you want to get into this ransomware affiliate program, you have to be referred by an existing affiliate or something like that in order to get in. This may also, considering that these ransomware crews are coming up with saying, you can't target this type of organization, this type of organization, this type of organization. So that's starting to shrink the target pool, the available targets for those people who are still going to conduct ransomware. So it might be that where hospitals were seen before as a lucrative target, now they're going to have to look for someone else. And maybe ransomware is going to start popping up in other silos that hadn't really been hit by ransomware very much in the past.
I mean, they're running out of municipalities to do it and small businesses.
Well, if there's a reaction like this, you know, if this is really a overall change in the mindset for how at least the United States government addresses these kinds of attacks, maybe when, you know, a local municipality gets hit, they go, you know, all in, just like they've done on the DarkSide. Then they're going to end up on the do not touch list as well. But the thing is, the government, as large as it is, still only has finite resources. So that list cannot be infinite. And say that anybody anywhere in the United States gets hit with ransomware are going to respond in kind.
Just FYI, I did a little side search on letters of marque, and there's an article from April 9th, 2020, Rebooting Letters of Marque for Private Sector Active Cyber Defense in the Journal of Cybersecurity Information Systems. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I'll take a look at that.
I'm going to stick that in the show notes. And a recent proposal to modify the criminal statute only makes some aspects of hacking back a defense to criminal prosecution. hacking victim engaged in defensive execute. So basically saying that hacking back, they could provide letters of marque to allow you to hack back when somebody gets you.
That would be interesting if the government did anything efficiently, because if you're getting attacked, by the time they get through the bureaucracy to give you your letter, it's going to be months later. And the benefit of that hack back, other than revenge, is going to be pretty low, I would assume.
See, I think they've got this wrong. All right, so here it says a 21st century cyber letter of marque would not grant U.S. corporations the right to capture a prize. However, a cyber letter of marque would permit the right of self-defense outside of a corporation's network borders. I think there's very little reason for corporations to go outside of their borders unless there was the option of a prize. Can you imagine where the cyber team becomes a profit center? Because they've got a good red team that when they get hacked, they're like, boom, like it's open season on this ransomware gang. Let's go get their Bitcoin.
Well, I don't know if that would be a profit center depending on how much you got hacked. But if you outsource that, saying that's a service you provided, hey, you have a letter of marque? Oh, you can use our red team to do X.
Yeah, maybe you have to put like a server, you know, establish a connection to be like, oh, we are their, you know, sub provider of this. And when the attackers broke into their network, they were also on our network.
Right, like a retainer.
Yeah, or a honeypot, putting up, you know, specifically vulnerable servers in their DMZ to try and trigger attackers to hit you.
Oh, right.
Oh, man, that would be so much fun.
Yeah, and that wouldn't be entrapment either because you're not the government.
Yeah, well, I mean...
But, you know, yeah, without... offering the company to get a prize, which they used to do, you know, those letters of marque for privateers.
Yeah.
They got those ships. They got the contents of the ships. They got all that stuff.
Yeah. No, they weren't doing it for, you know, patriot. I mean, there may have been a little patriotism involved, but it was a money-making opportunity.
Right. You know, Napoleon started doing away with that. He is quoted as saying, I'm going to forget the quote, or I'm going to butcher the quote. On something like, you'd be surprised what you can get a guy to do for a ribbon on his chest.
Yeah,
because soldiers and naval crews used to be able to get prizes as well, not just privateers. Mm-hmm. You see the old movie Horatio Hornblower with Gregory Peck. He's a naval captain and they capture a Spanish galleon and the entire crew is really upset with him because he decides to take that galleon and turn it over to I forget which country it is, but the leader of a small country in South America. So his crew is really upset because they don't get that prize and they'll get the money from that.
Yeah. No, and that would be, yeah. And again, like now you're able to add individual bonuses for each of the people that are doing it too, and maybe add like the bonus gets shared with the blue team people who caught the attacker and turned it around. Be real interesting. All right, but I took us on a side note. We've been talking for a while now. I don't know if you want to. Is there anything to close this one up?
So what you can do about it is nothing yet that you really haven't heard of before. This is no change to. This is not going to change the victim side of the ransomware, other than maybe who the targets are. So, you know, just plan to be ransomware, run your tabletops, talk to your legal team, make sure you test your backup plan. And as the MERSC thing demonstrates, do you have any kind of preparations in place for large scale recovery operations? And as well, these ransomware companies that are not just encrypting your data, but are also stealing your data. You got to remember that even if you pay, your data has still been taken out of your control.
Yeah, they're doing the quintuple ransom now. They ransom you once. If you pay, they ransom you again. Then they ransom the people. If they have data about personal people, they ransom them too. I'm only up to triples. There was like a fourth and a fifth method of ransoming in there somewhere. Oh, then part of the ransom is not to release the data. That's the fourth one. What's the fifth one? And I seem to remember there's a fifth method of getting paid for one breach, but it'll come to me.
But considering that data is out of your control, make sure you you consider what's in that data and if that data can then be leveraged to perform other attacks back against your organization. Because if they're able to steal data from certain servers, they may end up with unencrypted passwords, your vulnerability list, your audit findings, design documents, source code, any number of things that can then be leveraged to come back at you from another angle as well.
You just got it for me. 5 and 6. They could sell the documents to your competitors. That's payment number 5. They could sell the access and the password list and the vulnerability list to other hackers. That's 6 times they get paid off the same compromise.
You can see why this is so lucrative and why it's not going to go away anytime soon. I think we talked about this before. My opinion, operating system vendors have to get on top of this and figure this out. They got to get, you know, a dozen smart guys in a room and figure out how to do this from the operating system and have it just built into the OSs. Because until we get to that level where they can't, where this is really not viable, a viable activity anymore, just forget about it.
I don't know. I think some of the AV is doing a pretty good job. I think we've seen multiple instances where if it's running CrowdStrike or what other ones, Carbon Black, or there's one other one, like they would just shut down and not try to compromise it. So I think there's some evidence that some AV products are pretty effective.
That was SolarWinds tech that had that, those stipulations in there.
Gotcha.
No, you could always do the Russian keyboard thing. but that's a limited, that's going to give you limited benefit, but really the operating system guys have to do it because that's ubiquitous. If you have a computer, you've got an operating system on there. If that's what's preventing the ransomware, then you're covered. You can't rely on additional third-party stuff on top of that if you're going to really solve this, because not everybody's going to have those third-party applications installed and running. And you may have one installed, and that's not what that ransomware is looking for to shut down or whatever. So really, OS guys got to get on it.
So I've just figured out next week's joke. Now that I've changed my keyboard to Cyrillic, it's really slowed down my typing.
Nice.
It's going to be incredibly out of date by then, but all right. For the next article we have, this one should be a little shorter discussion. I think it's from Dark Reading and it's titled, "Don't Let the Scary Headline Shape Your Company's Cyber Resilience Strategy." Because I think we're all pretty familiar with the CISO who just went to a conference and comes back and wants to completely upend and turn around the direction where things are going because of something he saw at the conference or some headline he read while in the airport. So as a summary, it's pretty simple. Using headlines to make risk-based decisions is a pretty bad idea. And this is, in my opinion, this is very similar to poorly done threat intel, where a lot of the entry-level threat intel stuff, and I can get hate for this, please feel free to tweet at us at SerengetiSec on Twitter. Please tell me how wrong I am. But I feel like a lot of entry-level and bad threat intel is like, look at what the APT actors are doing and quickly pivot over so you can stop them from doing those things. And really, the only thing I have to say to that is two things. Number one, 90% of the bad guys you're facing are script kiddies, or they're these ransomware gangs where they're opportunistic. Sure, they have tactics that they tend to favor, but they're doing whatever gets them in. And second of all, even for the tactics they favor, the tactics they're using are the same ones that the APT actors are using. For example, once you get in, whether it's via phishing or a network attack, you're all spreading the same way. They're using RDP, they're using WMI, they're using PSExec, they're using, what's the last one I was thinking about? OSSH, something like that. And we'll talk about this in next week's episode about attack, but I think that if you look at all the different APTs and all the different threat actors out there, there's huge overlaps in some methods of how they're doing things. And I don't think that it's just like the headlines, using the headlines and using the threat intel to try and decide how to pivot and orient your strategy for long term is just a terrible idea. So the article does recommend that instead of using those headlines, they recommend a risk model that takes into account 3 factors, impact, scale, and frequency, which seems fine to me, honestly. I'd like to complain and rant and rave about it, but impact seems good, scale seems good, frequency seems good. They encourage cyber resilience. If you're following along with your bingo board at home, go ahead and cross that one off. And they advocate qualitative metrics. That's another thing that I'm generally a big fan of, but I think that qualitative metrics in terms of incident response and risk-based decisions from security operations is hard, and it's probably harder than it should be at this point in time. For example, if we knew the average loss, well, actually, we can figure out the average loss caused by a user clicking a link in an email. We can probably, you know, go over a year and we can add up all of the number of times that somebody's clicked an email that we've caught them, because you don't always catch them. We can probably add up all of the expense of cleaning up the malware infections and, you know, person hours and the business email compromise issues and the amount of money lost, and then divide that. But I think the problem is the impact and the scale and the frequency are all wildly divergent, where you get a lot of little events, like you get a lot of attempted business email compromise, wire transfer fraud, and malware infections. And then every now and then you get hit with one real big honker of a ransomware, just like a punch straight out of the corner of your eye. And I don't know that qualitative metrics really do a great job of picking out those black swan events. I don't know. Thoughts?
Yeah, it's really hard to determine what metrics you want to capture. Now, if you're considering, let's say, a phishing event where a user clicks on it and their credentials, you know, or their system is compromised. Now, if you know, or if you have something in like a project management system that says that their time is valued at X number of dollars per hour, then you might be able to extrapolate that out and say, all right, if we have one instance in the accounting department, and that's going to take them out for X number of hours or X days, then you could say, well, each equivalent attack for that type is going to cost X number of dollars. And then use historical metrics to say that we expect that on average, we're going to get X number of these per quarter. And that's going to cost us this much money, to give you an idea about what that cost is. And maybe that means that because the finance department is paid really well, whereas your facilities department is not paid that well, then someone in facilities getting compromised is not going to be as expensive as an accounting department. So then you shift some of your focus to better protecting those people. And it kind of goes to the conversation we had the other day about the tying your very attacked people with your very important people. Yeah. And determining what that is and what that really costs your organization.
But I think the problem here is that the frequency of those little attacks is so much, like they happen so often. You're getting phishing emails every single flipping day. You're, you know, seeing watering hole attacks frequently. You see those and you start to think that you start to spend all your time working on those things. And you start to think that that's your job and that's where these things are always going. And then you get hit with the, you know, once in 5 years breach that you couldn't predict because it happens, you know, once in 5 years. Because that's actually, oddly enough, I was thinking about that in the last article. You don't see a lot of these companies getting hit by ransomware again and again and again.
Well, either they learn their lesson or they're out of money.
Yeah, I don't know. That seems interesting to me because it feels like if they're weak enough to get hit by one ransomware group, I'm surprised the others don't. And if they pay, I'm surprised the others don't swarm after them like a bunch of sharks. But that's neither here nor there. But yeah, like, You're just doing the firefighting and you're just doing kind of your daily, the constant low grade firefighting of phishing and malware infections. And the stuff that really hits the impact and scale side has a tiny frequency on a, you know, annual factor or more.
Yeah, there's a formula for doing that math. I don't know what off the top of my head though. Infrequent event that has a high cost and you average that out, it's part of the CISSP risk calculation. Well, I'm not going to say it's CISSP, but something that when you study for the CISP, they talk about doing those kind of metrics for risk calculations. And like I said, I don't remember the formula off the top of my head, but they have that for those infrequent but high impact events. Which you have to understand the odds of those events, which may be difficult to clearly identify or delineate, unless you're going to say that compare your organization with other organizations within the field, let's say within your silo, which is retail or whatever, within the retail silo, how many organizations get hit with ransomware, and how does that equate to you? So if there are 1,000 retailers, 10% of those get hit annually. What are the odds of you being in that 10% every year, and what's that going to cost?
Anyways, I think that the qualitative metrics for the high impact events that are the black swans are super hard to actually calculate. And I think that having a lot of metrics is good because that's the stuff you're doing day to day. Like I said, those low grade firefighting items. But I think that focusing on those metrics is distracting from those big events. Anyways, according to Arwa Alhamed, who is quoted in the article, he believes resilience is based on three factors. And I almost hate to parrot this because I don't necessarily agree. You have to have the mindset of a hacker. I don't think that's related to cyber resilience. You can always make the argument that it makes you a better blue teamer, and I subscribe to that. But anyways, make it expensive and difficult. Now, that's probably the best piece of advice in there is, I mean, I think we've talked about this before, where you don't have to be the fastest runner when the bear comes after you, right? You just have to be the second slowest. And that's not 100% a great comparison here, because attackers can, hit more than one company, et cetera, but you don't want to be, as long as you're in the middle of the pack or better, the attackers will always have somebody easier to hit on. And finally,
in the article, he equated that something differently, but I agree with the way that you're looking at that statement, in that what you want to do is raise the cost of the attacker to make it more expensive for him to attack you than it's worth for him, that more than he's going to get out of it.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. I said, invest the most in protecting the crown jewels, the organization. Yeah. I disagree with that. I disagree with his particular characterization there. But
the only one of the three that I agree with that I even had in there was be well prepared. And that's the only one that even fits with the statement of resiliency. I don't think he knows what the definition of resilient is. You have to fail in order to show that you're resilient.
Mm-hmm.
So being prepared means that you can rebound from failure if you're prepared for that.
Yeah.
But having the mindset of a hacker and doing a whole bunch to protect your crown jewels is not going to improve your resilience.
That's fair. Yeah. Yep. Resilience is what happens after you fail. You're right. As a side note, that Boy Scout motto is the only thing that I've kept 20 years after Boy Scouts. I am no longer trustworthy, helpful, loyal, friendly, or kind. Maybe the difficult part in terms of, not providing an easy way. I'm thinking resilience in terms of resistance.
But that's still not it.
That's still not the strict definition of resilience. Hmm.
The resilience shows up after you failed. So after your crown jewels are already gone, all that money you spend into budget protecting them is not going to help you recover from that failure.
Yeah. All right. Well, and the other thing that I really liked out of this article is that there's a quote from McAfee, Steve Grobman, sometimes the most important things for an organization are the most boring or least exciting. That totally describes vulnerability management. That totally describes phishing review, patching. Yeah. Blocking stuff in your firewalls and your proxies.
Yeah. It's not sexy. It's kind of like the, when you see a lot of cybersecurity books or listen to podcasts you talk to new people getting into cybersecurity, they're talking about, they want to be on the red team. They want to do the attack stuff. You don't hear them a lot saying, oh, I want to do cyber defense and, figure out how to do defensive. They say they want to do cybersecurity in a defensive manner, but they don't actually want to be on the blue team, which you know, that's my background. That's what I prefer. So I'm probably just an outlier.
You just love Smurfs.
I did like Handy. He had that tool belt and the hammer.
All right. So why does this matter? If it's a good strategy, stick to it. Frankly, I would almost encourage you to ignore the news. That's honestly enough. I've been trying to cut out political news myself because it doesn't improve my life and it doesn't help me make better decisions. This is why if you've got a threat intel group, that's what they're doing, is they're supposed to be trying to find the interesting and important stuff to pass on to you. Next item, test what you're doing and determine if it is failing before switching. If you do want to switch, that's a big one. Is there a good reason to switch strategies at this point? Is what you're doing not working?
Or is the tool that you have not working? I don't know how many organizations I've been in where they've either incompletely deployed a tool, the tool is improperly configured, or they don't put personnel resources towards that tool. And then they say, oh, it's terrible. It's a piece of junk. Let's replace it with this new and shiny thing. Without really understanding that, you know, what you're doing is you're just going to fail at that again, because you're not properly allocating your resources to make that successful.
Yeah, most of the expense of the tool comes from after the purchase, right? The maintenance, the configuration.
Right.
Yep. And other item that comes out of this, you need to carve out time for improvement and preparation. This is something that I know that I have been consistently failing on, especially you're working on firefighting, you're working on getting your stuff done for the week, you're working on the incoming incidents. You know, there's always 10 million projects. We'll talk about this in a lot more depth in a couple of weeks when we do a book review on the Phoenix Project, but it's called out in there as well, where if you're not working on improving, then entropy means that your stuff is getting worse. Stuff is failing and you may not know it. Log sources aren't coming in anymore. Dashboards aren't working anymore. The alert that was great last year is not, you know, targeted at the room. Maybe the attacker switched their tactic up a little bit and the alert's no longer working the way you thought it was. If you are not doing that improvement, if you're not doing that preparation for those big black swan events, your capabilities are eroding. All right. I think that's about all we had for this one.
One thing I would mention as well is that when your leadership comes back from one of these conferences with these GFIs and says, hey, we need to do this thing, I think it's important for the lower level management or the engineers to be able to listen to what they have to say and then figure out what they think that is going to stop or what that's going to prevent, how that's going to improve the security, and put that in the context of what you're already doing or what the plan already is in place for. So if they come back and say, well, I think we should do X and that's going to prevent phishing attacks, to be able to take that input from them and say, oh, well, we're already on this path, or we already have this technology that's supposed to do that exact same thing. Let's not deviate from the plan. We're going to get what you want, but here's the milestone date, or here's the activity that we're going to conduct that's going to get you what you want as far as what that defensive measure is, versus turning the ship and doing something different, which is going to, because there's switching costs as well.
Yeah.
From moving from this to that, in addition to not going down that path anymore, which you've already, it's not exactly a sunk cost fallacy, but you're already down that path and losing that effort.
And a good comprehensive security strategy, if you had it before, probably covers just about everything anyways. Again, like we were talking about earlier, if your security strategy had a giant gap that you could drive a semi truck through, then yes, maybe you should reconsider things. But if it was a good comprehensive security strategy with a variety of controls that are applied at multiple layers, then, you know, an about switch is probably not buying you much. All right. Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have today. Thanks for listening to the Security Serengeti podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SerengetiSec. Download and listen from your favorite podcast application and leave us a review. I hear that does good things for search optimization and helps other people find and listen to the melodious sound of our voice. And that's something I think we could all do a little more of.